Dear followers of Emergence Live and EMSpedia, we are in line with Mr. Mark Winter, Service Manager of Children's Air Ambulance Service in Wales, to talk about the transport and treatment of pediatric patients with helicopter. It is very interesting speaking about a pediatric air ambulance, and so are the characteristics of this kind of transportation mean. So, Mr. Winter, it is rare to see a pediatric ambulance, as I said, dedicated only to pediatric services. Indeed, can you describe what are the main interventions you are performing?
Certainly. So we have two types of pediatric support and provision. We've got those that are life-threatening emergency calls that we would go out to as a primary helicopter emergency medical response. And then we've got those patients who we are transporting between hospital facilities who need specialist care from either a neonatal unit or specialist pediatric services. So what we tend to do is we have two different type of aircraft. We have a H145 Airbus helicopter, which is a larger airframe, which we use for our emergency work. And then when we're transporting our children around from one hospital to the other, we're utilizing an EC135 Airbus helicopter that is fitted with a specialist incubator that's electronic, that we can put the baby into, the same as if we were in a neonatal unit at a hospital. And then we've got another type of incubator where we can put a slightly larger child into, or we can convey children on a normal type of stretcher who don't need any extra sort of incubator support, but do need to be looked after, kept warm, and perhaps have some medication and fluids running. So that's the difference in the two types of treatment and transport that we provide to our smallest patients.
Yeah, and WAA operates on a large area from Pembrokeshire to Cardiff or the Snowdonia Park. What characteristics do you need to face so different environments?
Well, you're absolutely right. They are totally different in their makeup and their behaviour. We have rural areas that we don't have main artery motorway roads on. We have urban areas which are tight conurbations of people and buildings. And then we've got really sparsely populated areas such as the gorgeous mountains of Snowdonia in North Wales, where mountain flying is a totally different thing to your normal flying. So we have to take all of those features into account, and weather in Wales can be at times very challenging. It can be very wet because we're very near the coast, or if we're in the mountains, it can be wet and very cold. And we might see, like in Italy, snow up on the hills, but actually it's quite warm on the ground, a few thousand feet down. So we have to be prepared to be able to work with these different areas, and our pilots are specifically trained to do this. And a lot of our pilots are ex-military pilots who are used to working in these sorts of terrains and can offer a certain experience of having done so before. But also we work on beaches. You know, we don't winch. We don't have winches on our operation. We have specific search and rescue aircraft for that. But we can go and work on beaches, pick up patients from the sand and take them to hospitals. So we have to think about all of those things when we're engaging in flying, and we've got to think about weather, temperature, because we don't want icing on our helicopter blades, of course. We've got to have good visibility so that we can see where we're going, and use our navigation aids and our night vision goggles to help support us in that journey.
Yeah, these are characteristics that are so important to face such environments. And in particular, who are the emergency operators on board of the helicopters? Who composes air ambulances crew generally?
Okay, so in Wales, we have a consultant doctor who's background will either be emergency medicine or probably from an anaesthetics or intensive care background. And then working alongside that doctor, we will have a practitioner that's either from a paramedic or a nursing background. And collectively, they work together as a team of two. And then they have a pilot that obviously flies the aircraft and looks after that element. But the specialist thing about the role of a paramedic or nurse HEMS aircraft member is they also support the pilot in their duties. So they will do a what's determined a helicopter technical crew member's course, where for 2 weeks they'll learn about aviation, navigation, care in the air, you know, making sure that we're operating safely, fueling the helicopter. So they take on a bit of a double role. They're not just a paramedic or a nurse. They're also somebody who can support the doctor and the pilots, very much importantly as well.
Yeah. And how many interventions do you realize every year? And what are your range and the time of your operation?
Okay, so in the last year, from an emergency perspective, we undertook just short of 2,700 calls. Now, that works out about seven or eight a day. We operate on a 12-hour basis, 7 days a week. We're not currently working 24/7, but we hope to be in the not too distant future. So we operate a daytime service. But more importantly, of all of that work, if we took the children specifically, they attribute to about 17% of our overall workload. So we would do about 456, roughly speaking, of those calls a year involving children. And that would work out at least one, possibly one and a half a day. Not that you can have half a person, of course, but that's just how it goes. But more importantly, what we found is that our range of patients are going from brand newborns through to 100 years of age. We are dealing with a case mix which is 32% female and 68% male. And importantly, we bring certain skills and expertise to the roadside or at the home, and we take those skills away from the hospital out to the community. And in that time frame, we provided anaesthetics to 160 people and gave blood and blood products over 100 occasions in the pre-hospital environment. So using some very critical interventions to care for our sickest patients.
Okay. A helicopter EMS usually is created to perform as soon as possible the stabilization of the patient. Could you tell us what are the innovations and the devices that are improving your way of performing ALS?
I think there's a multitude of things that we can do in the pre-hospital arena to make it better for patients who are critically unwell. Good training, good education, learning all the time from colleagues around us and being up to date with all the principles and practices that provide such an important care pathway to this group of patients. Utilizing machinery that is of the very latest quality, that is absolutely reliable to us, is very important. So really good ventilators, having heart monitors and general vital signs monitors available to us are really important. The ability to look at patients not only as a individual, but taking blood gases and using technology in order to streamline our treatments and our medications towards what the patient needs best. The same as if you were in hospital. Because of the advanced decision making on board, we've got the critical care consultants and nurses and paramedics. They are trained to be able to work with this equipment and provide the best possible, you know, enhancements for patients who need that care. I think it's also important as well just to stress that, you know, we can bring ultrasound to the side of the patient. We can bring bloods I mentioned earlier on. And just making sure that we can stabilize, but very quickly, patients who are descending, and then we can bring them back to a place where hopefully we can get them to a place of safety where they can be looked after and have further care given to them once they're in hospital.
Yeah. And as we can imagine, there are two different settings between adult and pediatric air ambulance transportation. Why do you choose to operate pediatrics with an H135 and adults with the H145?
Okay, so there are a group of patients who will go on the H145 as standard.
Yeah.
If we're doing practical inter-hospital transfers of patients who need the electronic incubator, we've got an aircraft platform that we've been utilizing now for just over 18 months to do this work. And we're still going through a bit of a review process about what is the best type of helicopter, what can it bring. Clearly, being slightly smaller, it means that we can't take as much equipment, but we tend to take the patients in the 135 who are more settled, who are more stable, and actually their care interventions are slightly less than those from a pre-hospital primary emergency response type. So, you know, a child knocked down in the street by a car who's got a head injury will need the bigger platform on the 145 to be able to deal with that patient's needs, whereas a patient who's just going from one incubator bed to another may just need some basic support with their ventilation, with their respiratory effort, and we can do that with equipment, and we've got the space in the 135. I mean, eventually we hope to have a bigger aircraft, but our journey is we are a charity and we have to have the public support in order to get us the funding to make these changes happen, and upgrading a 135 to a 145, you know, it's quite an expensive leap. So we have to get the money in from the charity, from the public first, and then we can start to think about a bigger platform. But certainly, Children's Air Ambulance in Wales is a vital part of our operation.
Yeah.
And we can do most things with the 135 that we could do with the 145.
Let us be more specific on the devices. Why is it so important to rescue an infant or a child with dedicated devices? Why don't you use or adapt adult devices, for example, in pediatric patients?
Yeah, so I think the difference is that although children are little adults, they anatomically are different, and
yeah,
therefore we have to cater for them not only from a medical point of view but also from a patient positioning point of view. If you lay a child down and don't support their head properly, you could actually close off their airway because they're still in the formation of growing and their bones are developing. So we have to make sure that we're looking after them in a slightly different way. And because they are smaller, equipment has to be tailored to their needs. And they're still developing with their lungs, with their all their different systems in their body. And therefore, we have to make sure that our equipment matches what their body actually needs. And what we don't want to do is, for instance, apply a ventilation strategy and then find that we're overinflating their lungs. So we have to use fine-tooled ventilatory equipment to make sure that we're looking after them. But equally, when it comes to the safety of transportation, we've got to make sure that children are looked after the same as if they were going into a car. And that way you'd have them properly strapped in, they'd probably be in a car seat, we can pop them into an incubator, all of this equipment can be firmly placed into the aircraft and looked after and locked in. So in the event there was to be a bit of a rough landing or something like that, they're not going to go anywhere. They're going to be nice and safe and protected in their environment.
And transporting an ICU team to the patient means also to have a direct link with the hospital, which is very important. Or what kind of data about the patient you can share actually with the operating room in the hospital?
Yep. So we tend to provide information about patients' conditions between clinicians using radio or telephony as a standard practice. And we have software that we're developing at the moment so that we'll be able to send vital signs recordings from the aircraft whilst en route to the hospital if we need to do so. But bearing in mind we do have advanced clinical decision making on board, like I said earlier on, we've got people who can diagnose and treat certain conditions. So what it does allow us to do is to provide a direct access to specialist services at the hospital. So we can pass through information and vital signs and clinical information about the patient. If we need to go straight to a heart attack centre and we need to go to a lab in order to get the patient's arteries reopened, then we can do that, or we could go straight to a scanner rather than go via the emergency room first. So we can do that because we have the advanced decision making, but we know there is further work that we want to do. So our aircraft now have the ability to use 4G technology in flight, and we can pass that information through the internet through to the hospital in a secure way, so the receiving hospital can see it. So there's a lot of work going on at the moment, but more importantly, with our equipment, we pull off trends and patient clinical information when we arrive at the hospital, and we share that with the team. So they have got a history of the patient from our perspective in the time that we've been with them and the monitoring's been on. And it's really important to have that so that when we come to do our follow-ups with our data linkages, we know exactly what's been going on. And also, it's for review. We run a governance day, clinical governance day, every month. And we're always learning from the cases that we go to and sharing that learning with other people. Because in order to make sure that we get the right treatment for the next patient, we've got to review what we did with the last patient. So it's really important that we do that.
Yes, of course. And in your experience, what are actually the main interesting developments for critical care?
I think with critical care, it's being able to provide the most up-to-date medicine arrangements in conjunction with the other issues such as blood products in the pre-hospital arena. For us, having that level of care available to us so that we can give to our most unwell patients a very good chance of stabilizing them, because for so many years, we've carried fluids that are saline, sort of salty water in nature, but don't carry all the nutrients and the goodness and the oxygen and the carbon dioxide in and around the body. So this way, we can actually provide that really good stabilization for the blood system at source. I think it's also the decision making and making sure that patients are getting signposted to the right place first time. We can cut out an awful lot of time wasted by going to somewhere where we need to then take them somewhere else. So we're reducing the amount of secondary transfers that are being undertaken, and having direct conversations between the scene and with hospital clinicians, we can build up a picture very quickly where we know there's space to be able to take a poorly patient and get them looked after very quickly.